Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Sunday, September 10th, 2017, and this is show number 644. Well, we're just 2 days away from the big announcement from Apple, and everybody's all excited about it. Remember, if you want to join your fellow Nosilla castaways in a chat room during the announcement, you can head on over to podfeed.com/live and join in all the fun. Reminder, I will not be on video because we'll all be watching Apple, right? If you haven't been in the live chat before, though, this is a great time to try it out, and it's actually at a reasonable hour for our European and more Eastern nations. I'm looking at you, Haley. I expect you to be there. Anyway, there's instructions over at podfeed.com/live, so I hope you'll come over and join us. In Chit Chat Across the Pond this week, I invited Joe Duganzik back to the show to talk to us. I wanted him to talk about his new Illustrated HomeKit product guide. It's great fun, as always, to talk to Joe, and in this case, he explains what kind of products are available now for HomeKit. And it's really cool because he's got these separated into sections, not by vendor, but by what they do. So there's a section for lighting, outlets and sockets, wall dimmers and switches, security devices like locks and cameras. There's thermostats, ceiling fans and shades, fire and smoke detectors, specialized sensors, you know, like for air quality and water leaks. And there's even smart buttons, which I think are actually dumb buttons. But anyway, they've got them there. Check this episode out, in either Chit Chat Across the Pond Lite or the full Chit Chat Across the Pond feed in your favorite podcatcher of choice. Well, I think I mentioned last week or the week before that when I thought I was going to be out on vacation, Alistair Jenks had agreed to do the podcast, and he did a bunch of recordings for us, but then life got in the way and he wasn't able to host the show, and then I was able to do more content that week, so I've been milking out his recordings, and it turned out to be really, really helpful this week in particular. Steve and I had Forbes and Dodger, Lindsay and Nolan's son and dog, and we had him for about 4 days, and we had a great time. He is a delightful baby and a great dog, but we're too old to be parents of an infant, let me tell you that. So I didn't get a lot done, and so having Alistair's audio here to help us out and flesh out the show was fantastic. So let's have a listen to Alistair.
This piece started out as a simple review of one piece of software, but as I began writing, I realized it's one of those times where a bit of storytelling is in order. Some listeners will know that I once had a podcast of my own. Technically, I still do, but it's a pretty rare release these days. I started right around the same time Alison did, but instead of tech, my podcast was about music. I was listening to Adam Curry's Daily Source Code podcast as he began to imagine the future of music and podcasting. When he set up the PodSafe Music Network and PodShow, I had all I needed to get underway as I reached the "I could do this" point. I hosted on PodShow's service and sourced all the music I played from the PodSafe Music Network. Importantly, my recording was done with the very simple CastBlaster software, which was commissioned by PodShow. CastBlaster followed Adam's own preferred model of recording, live in one take. A Windows application, it was a player and recorder, with a number of cart slots for jingles, more for music tracks, plus basic recording and playback controls. After setting it up, you hit record and could then fire your jingles and music, open and close the microphone, and monitor things as you went. When done recording, it had features to add tags, encode to MP3, and upload to a server. It was a one-stop shop, and I loved it. Roll forward 16 months, and I ditched my PC for my first Mac. Like many Mac users, I made do with GarageBand, but I necessarily had to completely change how I recorded. I managed to work out a pseudo-live recording process, but it was messy and prone to issues. As a result of these problems, I was constantly on the lookout for a better way and eventually came across Ubercaster. Ubercaster was the best of CastBlaster and GarageBand combined. Like CastBlaster, it was a true one-stop shop for podcast creation, and it enabled all the setup ahead of time and live-in-one-take recording. But it also had all the power of GarageBand after recording, as it laid down each jingle or song on a separate editable track. On the odd occasion where I mistimed a song or started the wrong one, it was really no problem as I could just continue recording in the knowledge I could return and edit out the problem later. Recording with Ubercaster was pure joy. And then the joy stopped. The developer got really sick right around the time he realized it needed a complete rewrite to work with future versions of OS X. He tried to find a buyer for it, but was unsuccessful. A couple of minor updates were released to make it mostly work on newer OS versions, but the writing was on the wall, and eventually it stopped working. I'd begun pod fading while Ubercaster was still a going concern, but when I could no longer do my live and one take recordings so effortlessly, I rarely had the inclination to record. I managed to put a handful of shows together with GarageBand and later upgraded to Logic, but still the same basic issues persisted. It was too much work to prepare and operate the recording process to maintain the one-take flow. Sometimes I cheated and assembled my pieces to microphone with the songs in a pure editing process, but I didn't feel right about the result. My life has gone in all sorts of directions in the last 18 months, none of which were inspiring me to record, unless Allison decided to try for a record number of vacations and needed my help, like now. As life began to settle down a bit, I began hankering once again to get behind the microphone. I'd worked out by this stage that I could legally play almost any music, and that filled me with all sorts of anticipation. So earlier this year, I once again set about searching for software that could give me back my mojo. After a fashion, a rather geeky fashion, I found the answer. But I didn't find it in a single piece of software, rather a suite of top-notch tools that I have working together. I already had most of the parts, but one new application provided the vital missing piece. Mix 16 Pro is an application by Gregor Krasovic. I'm hoping I'm saying that correctly. Gregor is a professional theatre sound engineer and he created the software to solve his own problems. I have to say he has done a fantastic job with it. Its intended use is to run a theatre show, to which end it allows 64 audio files, 64 video files and 64 images to be set up ahead of time and then fired either at random or according to a prescribed playlist. It has all the controls you'd expect, including individual volumes, plus master volume, timers for each clip, and more. And it looks great. I trialed a handful of similar apps in my search, and every other app was either less capable or less enjoyable to use. Some were also far more expensive. One of the key features I needed was the ability to route each audio clip. Some of the other apps enabled each clip to be routed to specific channels of specific audio devices, and this is what I thought I needed to achieve true multi-track recording in Logic. Logic can record any number of channels from an audio device. An audio device. You can only use one audio device at a time for input to Logic. Mix 16 Pro can output to the default channels of any number of audio devices. Two channels on lots of devices versus lots of channels on one device. It seemed an impossible ask, but another very clever app came to my rescue. Allison has mentioned Loopback from Rogue Amoeba on a previous show. Remember the one where she lost her voice? Loopback is an audio routing tool, and with a little thought, I realized it could create both of these things and connect them up. I wanted to allow for 8 songs plus a jingles track, plus, of course, my microphone. I created 9 new sound devices in Loopback, which are simple pass-through devices. Each has 2 channels for stereo sound. I then created a master device with a whole bunch of channels. This is an aggregate device that includes the 9 pass-through devices and my microphone interface. Loopback allows you to set the channel mapping so that each input device's channel pair maps to a unique channel pair on the aggregate. With all that in place, I select the aggregate device as input in Logic and then create a track assigned to each channel pair. The net effect of all this is I once again have the ability to record live in one take and still have a fully editable multi-track output. The only slight difference from the Ubercaster model is that all of the tracks are recording all of the time. In Ubercaster, the tracks only recorded when audio was played for them, but there should be no noise on anything but the microphone track, so trimming won't be necessary, except perhaps for my sanity if I end up having to do an edit. I will add at this point that the developer of Mix 16 Pro is very responsive. He answered several questions for me before I bought his app. After I bought it, I made 3 requests for enhancement. He asked me to clarify one and then delivered on all three within a week or two. I went back with more later, and he has delivered on those too. Here's what he wrote to me when I thanked him for the amazing support. User experience and good support is very important to me. My apps would not be as good as they are without users. I carefully read every idea and problem and try to respond as quick as I can. I hate companies which advertise 24-hour response and then you wait for a few days and even then the answer is usually, it cannot be done. Once I got into testing Mix 16 Pro, I noticed it had a facility for MIDI control. It could accept MIDI commands to trigger its actions and could send out MIDI commands as a result of its actions. This got me to thinking. I was sure I'd seen something a long time ago on iOS that could act as a configurable MIDI control surface. You know, those cool-looking panels with coloured lights you see on some musicians' desks? After a little searching, I found a TouchOSC. This app allows for both MIDI and OSC control messages to be sent and received by means of a highly configurable simulated control surface. Unfortunately, you cannot configure the surfaces on iOS. You have to use a Mac. More unfortunately, you have to have Java installed. With the Mac app set up, you can design your control surface quite easily and then have the Mac and iOS apps link up wirelessly on the same Wi-Fi network to load up the configuration. This whole process is a little esoteric, but not hard if you follow the fairly comprehensive documentation. By trial and error, I was able to tie up the control surface commands with those in Mix 16 Pro. During this process, the developer once again showed his willingness to support his users. I asked if additional MIDI functions could be supported, and also if he could support a whole new mode of operation. Needless to say, after a few clarifications, he delivered all I had asked for, while at the same time making sure his existing users would not be surprised or disadvantaged. I went one step further and configured the control surface to send a command to Logic 2. This one mutes and unmutes the microphone track, so I now have complete control of my recording session from a single screen on my iPad. With all of these pieces in place, recording is once again enjoyable and live in one take. Let's see if I can pump out some more Sitting Duck podcasts this year. Links for all of the software mentioned are in the show notes.
Well, hey, thanks, Alistair. That was great. I think anything that makes you do more podcasting is a good thing. Makes me wish that I liked music, but at least for everybody else, it gives you the opportunity to get back in and have some more fun with it. I did actually listen to a couple of episodes of the Sitting Duck podcast, and I kind of liked it, even without liking music. So, you know, go figure. Well, speaking of listener reviews, Denise has sent in a review of an interesting product that I'm sure you've heard about, but to hear it from one of our very own Nocilla castaways is even more fun. Let's listen to Denise.
Greetings, fellow castaways. Denise Crown here with a review of Snapchat Spectacles. In a nutshell, spectacles are sunglasses with a built-in camera. We do not violate the Podfeet terms of service, so regulations require we start with the problem to be solved. Say you're out walking the dog, hanging out with friends, at a festival, at an amusement park, or doing some fun outdoor activity. You can capture some of that without carrying your phone or bolting a GoPro to your head. Before you dismiss this as something only for the millennials, these things are really fun. I tried them outdoors, while driving, and even in my office, and they worked well as both sunglasses and a video camera. Plan to take them to an upcoming trade show. I feel like Snap took a lot of the complaints people had with Google Glass and came out with a more public-friendly, less creepy version. You can tell when you're being filmed because there's a very visible ring of white light on one temple when the specs are recording. The wearer also knows when their video starts and stops because you can see a light in your peripheral vision. This light has a third purpose. It tells you your battery status. As sunglasses, they're pretty great, well-made and not too heavy. They come in teal, red, and black. My only knock on the design is that they're round, and I think that some other styles would be more flattering on more faces. My guess is they were going for a unique look for the early adopters, and they'll soon make more mainstream shapes and colors. Specs will record about 100 snaps, which is a 10-second segment per charge, so you can have a pretty good day on the town, considering the charging case will charge them four times. So you're good for about 400 snaps before you need to find electricity or a USB port. You can link three snaps together for a 30-second video. There are two resolution choices. Both are filmed simultaneously, 704 by 704 and 1088 by 1088. One odd thing, to get the HD version out of your specs, you need to connect to a special Wi-Fi network named after your glasses. Snaps are synced over Wi-Fi to Snapchat on your iPhone, iOS 8 or later, or Android phone 4.3 or later with BLE and Wi-Fi Direct, whatever that is, slight Apple bias. In approximately 20 cities, they have cool vending machines with virtual try-ons, and if you want to buy them, you just swipe your card and pick a color. I love this retail trend of vending machines. I stare at the Best Buy kiosk and Benefit Cosmetics at every airport I visit. Go check out Carvana if you're shopping for a car. Just amazing. But I digress. If there's no vending machine in your area, you can use Allison's link and buy them from Amazon or order them directly from snapspectacles.com website where shipping is free. The packaging is really delightful. It comes in a tube like a package of tennis balls. Included are instructions, a cleaning cloth, a triangular carrying case that doubles as the charger, and a proprietary charging cable for recharging the case. The charging case will charge the specs four times before you need to charge it. Should you be so inclined, you can take them to any optician and have prescription lenses added, and there are even third-party accessory lenses you can buy. Pairing them to your phone is quite simple. You download the Snapchat app, take a picture of your avatar after you create it, and they pair. One big benefit is that you can use them without having your phone present. Your snaps will sync back to your phone when you're within range. Now, the Snapchat app is the weakest link in the chain. The user interface takes some time getting used to. Once you have the videos imported into the app, though, you can apply all the usual filters and emojis that are included with Snapchat and be just like the kids. You can save videos to your camera roll or share them like any other Snapchat video. Included for your enjoyment is a sample video I shot on my first day trying them out. Specs are $129.99 US, can be returned within 30 days, and carry a one-year warranty. I highly recommend them.
You know, I never would have thought of Snapchat spectacles as actually being something this good. After listening to Denise, I happened to mention the review she did to our friend Pat Dangler, and she came over last night, and she brought her pair over. And they are really well made, like Denise said. They're kind of heavy, but not heavy in a bad way. Heavy as in well constructed. You know, they look kind of cartoony, but they're really, really well constructed, and the case is really cool, like she said. And it was really fun to play around with them and take videos. I was surprised we never figured out how to take photos with them, but taking videos was super easy. So we took some videos of Forbes and playing around on the ground with him, and it was really, really great fun. So I really appreciate Denise doing this, and I did force her to send me a photo of her actually wearing the glasses, and she submitted under duress. She did allow us to have that photo. Well, right about this time of the show, I usually talk to you about ways you can support the NoSillaCast and other PodFeed podcasts, you know, like contributing to the PodFeed Patreon or using my Amazon affiliate links. But this week, I'd like to suggest you contribute to Bart's Patreon. Bart does two great podcasts of his own over at lets-talk.ie. There's Let's Talk Apple, which is a monthly analysis of the month's news about Apple with a rotating panel of interesting guests. Let's Talk Photography is also monthly, and it's about the art of photography, not about gear, but how to create great photographs. Bart does these shows and creates the amazing tutorials for programming by stealth and creates the bi-monthly security bits, all for the love of these subjects. But hosting his shows does cost money, so he has a Patreon to try to offset these costs. If you listen to his shows, or if you only listen to him here on the PodFeed podcast, I'd really like you to consider going to patreon.com/LTPod, there's a link in the show notes, and help him and support him in all the great things that he does for all of us. Steve's mother, Merlee, is very clever and quick learning new things, so we thought it was time to try to convince her to move from a flip phone to an iPhone. I should mention that her flip phone lives in a drawer and never gets to come out to play unless she's on a vacation. Steve's father, Ken, also has a flip phone he brings out for vacations, but he tends to be more resistant to trying new things in the technology department. I have observed, though, that when Merlee moves out on new tech, sometimes Ken watches over her shoulder and he eventually jumps in. Ken was convinced, though, that Merlee did not need an iPhone and that it would be excessively complex and she would never use it. He was also concerned about the cost. He pointed out that he only pays something like $40 a year for two phones with 20 minutes of calls and some limited number of text messages. So if it was more than that, it would be a big waste of money. One of our main motivations for getting Merlee onto a smartphone was because of how much she misses. When Merlee and Ken take the entire family on vacation, they often miss meeting spots and planning because they are not on the text message threads. Steve's nephew did spend some time with Merlee, teaching her to text on her flip phone, and she actually succeeded once or twice at reading and sending messages, but it was painful to watch how hard she was having to work at it. We were at the beach one day, and I had to tease her because she kept playing with her phone instead of enjoying the surroundings. What that did tell us, though, was that she was motivated, and that meant we figured we had a high probability of success. Right around the time we were thinking of doing this, Kyle's girlfriend Nikki gave me her old iPhone. It was a 16-gigabyte iPhone 6, and she didn't care if we sold it or gave it away. I suggested to her that it go to Merlee, and she was delighted. Nikki adores Merlee, so this was a perfect fit. Another reason we thought she was ready is because she already uses and loves her iPad. She wasn't convinced that the iPhone had any great value because she already has the iPad, but she was willing to give it a go. She was even more excited when I told her we could add her to our family plan on AT&T for only $15 a month. We share 18 gigabytes amongst the four of us, and we rarely get close to using all of it, and I figured she probably wouldn't be a big drain on our data usage anyway. Now that we had her on board, we had to plan a strategy. Merlee and Ken are about 2 hours away in San Diego, and one of the mistakes we've made in the past is to dump new technology on them in a short visit and then run away back home. Either things stop working as expected, or they forget something we did. Either way, this is not an ideal way to do it. With something as complex as a new phone, it seemed that strategy would be unsuccessful in the end. Lindsay and Nolan, and more importantly Forbes, live in San Diego as well, and we had a trip planned to go take care of Forbes while Lindsay and Nolan went off on a mini vacation. So we decided to combine the two plans. We'd go down to Forbes on Friday, and on Saturday make a day trip to introduce Merlee to the phone. We'd limit what we taught her to some basics. Then we'd scuttle off back to Lindsay's house and leave Merlee alone with the phone for a day, but then turn around and come back on Monday after we were done taking care of Forbes and stay the night. That would give her a chance to play with it for a bit, get some questions together, and then teach her a few more things if it was going well. With that part of the strategy complete, now we had to think about what we needed to teach her, what we wanted to teach her, and what parts of using a smartphone could or should be moved off to a future visit. We started with a shared wonder list between Steve and me, where we simply brainstormed everything we could teach her. By the way, I know Wonderlist is being deprecated, but I still don't have a viable alternative, so if anybody has any ideas, let me know. Anyway, once we had a list together, we started to drag the subjects up and down into an order that made sense. We added additional subtasks to some of the items to kind of flesh out our strategy. Setting up the order was an interesting thought process. We looked through our list and tried to figure out which items would be the most motivating to her to actually carry the iPhone around with her. If we could get her to carry it and keep it turned on, then the other items would be easier to sell. Steve's parents are very conscious about safety. It's not just that they're of advanced years. They've always been this way. I think it's because Ken worked in the insurance industry and saw what awful things can happen to people. Personally, I don't think I'd be able to step outside if I ever had a job in insurance. Anyway, with safety as a top priority, we gathered together those topics about the iPhone that would help increase her safety. We explained that if she had her iPhone with her, she could dial emergency services at any time. If she were out alone and she were in trouble, if she were with Ken and something happened to him, or if she saw someone else in distress, she'd be able to immediately get assistance. Find friends was next on our list. She's going to be living closer to one of her daughters eventually, and so it'd be nice for her daughter to be able to see where she is, again, for safety reasons. She could also see where all of us are when we're on vacation together. Whenever we go see her, we use the mapping app Glimpse to show her exactly when we'll be arriving so she knows the value of being able to see someone on a map. Whenever we travel, Ken reminds us to pack flashlights. I showed Merlee how her new phone is also a flashlight, and she was delighted. I threw out a few scenarios for using it, like finding a keyhole in the dark, walking in the evening, or tripping, had a high probability. At least it does for me in the dark. I have trouble with that. Both Ken and Merlee are also very much focused on security. Ken is famous for his starring role in the video Octogenarian Talks About 1Password on YouTube, where he explains his belief in the importance of using a password manager. However, he and Merlee don't have quite enough faith to put their 1Password vault online. I can respect their decision, even though I've made another choice. But that meant, though, that convincing her to use 1Password on her phone was a non-starter. But I could help her to learn to use Touch ID to log into her phone. It's good to work with other people on something like this because you begin to learn that some things don't work well for everyone. I think I must have the perfect finger dampness level because it's pretty flawless for me unless I've just jumped out of the shower. Kyle's fingers are a bit too damp, and it turns out Merlee's are a bit too dry. It took quite a few times to teach the phone her fingerprint. I told her to lick her finger before using it, and she looked at me like I had two heads, but sure enough, Touch ID worked better for her when she did lick her finger first. I'm not sure she's going to keep doing that, but she's got a good passcode, so I think she'll be okay. Now, Merlee does like to take pictures, but only carries a camera on vacations. I showed her how to use the camera on her iPhone, and she loved it. She immediately took a photo of Forbes sound asleep on the floor and was delighted that she could capture that moment. As I mentioned up front, we really wanted to get Merlee into text messaging. We had a phased strategy to get her on board. First, I taught her how to use iMessage while I was with her. Then we told her two daughters about the iPhone while we were away that one day, encouraging them to text her. Then after we left on Monday, I wrote to all of her nieces and nephews and encouraged them to start dropping her silly little notes about their lives. While I was teaching Merlee about iMessage, I explained to her that she could attach photos. Merlee wrote a message to Lindsay and attached her picture of Forbes asleep on the floor. Imagine Merlee's delight when she was able to share that and then get back a super happy message from Lindsay, who is missing her baby desperately. Later, when we connected her into a message thread with her two daughters, she found out that her son-in-law was getting a tattoo and not only saw pictures of her family out and about, but also got to see the tattoo. Side note here, the tattoo was pretty cool. A couple of years ago, the seemingly perfectly healthy man had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Because of the quick action of a bystander who saw him on the sidewalk next to his bicycle, he survived this heart attack. He survived it well. The tattoo he got shows a flat line. And above it, it says, "Not today." And then a heartbeat going after that. Gives me chills just to think about it. Anyway, Merlee knew all of this because of her new iPhone. Now, Merlee wasn't bad at all at typing on her iPhone, considering it was her first day. I explained to her that typos are much more forgivable in text messaging because everybody knows how hard it is to type on our little phones. She seemed to accept that, so I showed her how she could dictate into the phone and then just fix any typos it made. She was thrilled. She immediately started writing more complex and lengthy messages, another hurdle overcome. Now, Merlee is a frequent beneficiary of FaceTime from her family. We're almost all on iOS. She receives them on her iPad and her Mac, so seeing it on her iPhone wasn't a huge thrill, but the first time it happens when she's not at home, I think she'll get how cool this is. Now, I'm not sure when I did this for her, but I had already turned on iCloud Photo Library on her Mac and on her iPad. She didn't do too much on her iPad, but when I showed her all of her photos were on her phone, she was yet again delighted. I thought another good strategy would be to help her customize her iPhone to her liking. I first moved all of the applications she would be unlikely to use onto a second screen. Then I took her into the accessibility section of the phone. Merlee is blessed with terrific vision, using glasses only for super close-up work. I showed her where she could change the font size, and I let her drag the slider up and down until she found a spot where it was easily readable for her. Now, letting her do this herself, I think it helped her feel she was controlling her own environment, and that helps with ownership of the device. Next, we went on to ringtones, which I thought she wouldn't care about. I was wrong. She has a friend who has a super annoying ringtone, you know, one of those ones that goes on and on and on. Well, because of that, she wanted something simple and not annoying to others. I think she really enjoyed picking that out herself. Next, I explained that she could modify her desktop wallpaper and the lock screen on her phone. I figured she'd say she didn't care about that, but again, I was wrong. She had just received a photo of a painting of her father's cabin on Spirit Lake in Idaho. Even though it was a landscape image, we were able to slide it around and make it fit perfectly. When she saw her phone's lock screen showing that precious memory to her, she held the phone to her chest. It got to her heart. And I think that's the real magic pixie dust that Apple has put into the phones. They give us that visceral level emotional connection. It's hard to explain, but you know when you feel it. Now, we also thought that she would want us to put her music on her phone. But again, we were wrong. She said she has it on her iPod and she walks with her iPod in her pocket, so why would she need it on her phone? We tried to explain that having her phone with her was a safety feature and easy enough to carry, but she really didn't want to take that step yet. We have a feeling that once she gets used to keeping the phone with her, she'll want her music, but there's really no need to push her into that now. Now, what better way to customize an iPhone than to get your own case? Way back in the iPad Pro keyboard debacle, remember I actually ended up making money on that deal? Apple gave me a store gift card to replace the iPad Pro that was more than what I paid for it originally, so I had just enough money left to buy Merlee a new case. We went to the Apple store and she picked out one just perfect for her, and again, she was delighted. Now remember our strategy to come back 2 days later to see how she was doing? Well, get this. She showed me a really adorable thank you note that she'd gotten from her great-granddaughter, Selah, and her great-grandson, Jack. On the note, Selah had written 100% and a smiley face next to it, and then 60% and a frowny face. Merlee was confused about what it could mean. But here's the best part. She whipped out her new iPhone and showed me that she had texted a photo of the note and texted it to her daughter, Linda, to see if she could interpret what it meant. I love that she was already comfortable enough to do all that with her new phone. By the way, in case you were wondering, Selah was 100% happy to have spent so much fun time with her great-grandmother on vacation and 60% sad to leave her. Well, I hope this little story will help you if you ever find yourself trying to convince someone to get a new smartphone. Remember to make a strategy that includes getting them comfortable at their own pace and figuring out what's important to them first, not what you think is cool about a device. And most of all, be prepared to be wrong about what they will care about. If you ever write into the No Silicast with something really cool, you need to realize that you will be punished by being asked to make a recording. This happened to someone just recently, and I will let him tell it to you in his own voice.
Good morning, Ellison and the Silicast listeners. This is Joop from the slowly turning into autumn Netherlands. Last Monday, during my morning commute into work, I was listening to the latest NoSilicast, and I heard Bart mentioning the importance of a good backup as part of the security strategy, and I do so much agree. So I thought, let me describe my setup to your listeners. Maybe this might be useful to them in some way. So here at home, I have a number of Macs and MacBooks and a Linux server. And I have all my Macs set up to use Apple's Time Machine backup. When you initially set up Time Machine on the Mac, it will ask you to point it to a backup device, and that's basically all the configuration you have to do to make it work. But you can do more. My first backup device is a 3 TB Apple Time Capsule. But I also have a Synology NAS. Synology makes it very easy to create a Time Machine compatible backup folder. Using the web interface on the Synology, it would take you about 5 minutes or so. Once you have done that, you can also add this backup folder to your Time Machine configuration on your Mac. So now you have 2 devices configured for your Time Machine backup. Then what happens is that on 1 hour, the backup will go to the Time Capsule. And the next time around, so the next hour, it will go to the Synology backup folder. And so on, switching devices every hour. So basically, now I have 2 separate backup devices and 2 separate backups in my house being updated hourly. But what if there was a fire or a flood? Then I would lose and my Macs and my backups, and I still don't have anything. So the next step I did is set up Amazon Glacier as a third backup. This is a specific Amazon service for data storage for which you don't have to read often. So typically backups. The writing and storing of the data is very cheap. My bill last month was just under €4 for, I guess, about 500 gigs of data. Reading data from the Glacier storage is a bit more expensive, but still cheap. And I hardly need to read it anyway because there are backups and I have my local backups. So back to my NAS. Synology supplies a utility for Glacier backups. And if it's not installed on default, you can install it from the packet center on the Synology. And there is a nice technical write-up on the Synology site guiding you through the setup. And I don't guess, all in all, it takes you about 15 minutes to configure. And now, once a day, my backup folder is synced to the Glacier backup. So in my case, I now have the original data on my Macs. I have two independent backups on two different devices in-house, and I have one backup device off-site. But I'm in IT too long to trust computers. So my personal operation procedure is that in the spring, I pick one of my Macs, I wipe it, and I restore it from the time capsule backup, just to make sure that it works. And at the same hand, usually in the autumn, and I'm planning to do it next weekend, I'm doing the same with the Glacier backup. I wipe a machine and then restore from the Glacier service. If you do it the first time, it takes a little bit longer to restore the data because the way the Glacier is set up, they have to get it from the offline storage first. So it may take a couple of hours before it starts, but then it works smoothly and you can restore to your local Synology and then restore the Mac from the Synology. So I guess many people might find this excessive, but to me, my business documents, my code I've written, all the pictures I've taken in the past and the memories associated with it, they are too important to me to lose. So this is the way I have set it up, and it's hardly any hassle. It doesn't need any big maintenance, and it helps. Somebody can use it, and it makes some sense. Looking forward to listening to the next NozillaCast. Have a nice day. Greetings, Joop, or like we say here, have a fijne dag and veel plezier.
Well, Joop, I thank you so much for making this recording. One of the reasons I like to punish people and make them do recordings is, as Joop found out, it's hard to do these recordings. Anyway, this is fantastic, Joop. I really, really like that. It's something I'm going to aspire to. I'm not sure I'll be able to get up to your level, but it's pretty cool to learn about. And learning about how Joop uses Amazon Glacier, right after learning about B2 from Backblaze that Alistair uses, I'm really starting to think about what stuff I can put offsite that I never thought I could really afford to do before. So I really thank you for sending this in, Joop. This was fantastic. I take a lot of screenshots for quite a few different uses. I like to use them in my blog posts when I'm reviewing applications. I like to use them when doing tech support and emails to my friends and family, and also to send in to listeners who write in with questions. I also use screenshots to demonstrate problem areas when communicating with software developers about their products. I'd like to tell you about a menu bar app called TeamPaper Snap that might be a better tool for you than some of the built-in capabilities of macOS. But first, let's set up some problems to be solved. I do so many screenshots that I'm pretty comfortable using the keystrokes built into macOS to capture a specific area, an application window, or even full screen. For some, or maybe many people, remembering those keystrokes is a real big pain, and so they just don't do it. Apple has the built-in Grab application. If you didn't hear about that, you'll find it in application/utilities, and that might be easier for you. It's a pretty useful tool with time screenshots that's handy for capturing a pull-down window. But once a screen capture has been acquired, it's often desirable to add some annotations. Now, you know I'm a huge fan of Clarify from clarify-it.com for using a series of screenshots and annotating them. But most of the time, I only need to get my point across with a single screenshot, and that's a bit of a sledgehammer for this single-shot need. For my one-shot annotation needs, I usually do the Command-Control-Shift-4 keystroke dance to capture an area to the clipboard. And then I open Preview with Spotlight, and then I hit Command-N for a new window from the clipboard, and my screenshot opens. Sometimes, if I'm feeling frisky, I tap on the touch bar and select Open in Preview first instead of doing Command-N. Once I'm in Preview, I tap on the toolbox to reveal the tools to annotate the image. In recent versions of macOS, you can also paste a screenshot directly into an email and hit the little disclosure triangle to open it in markup and annotate that image as required, you know, with shapes and text. It's the same features that are available in Preview if you hit that little toolbox. It works, but it's got some drawbacks. The main thing I don't like about annotating in Preview/markup is how you don't get to just draw the shapes where you want them. When you hit the box icon, for example, it just plops a box on the screenshot immediately. Then you have to drag the top, bottom, left, and right independently to get it to where you want it. Same thing with an arrow. You have to drag the start and end points around to get it pointing where you want it. So I think it's much more efficient to just draw a box or click and drag an arrow. I do like the flexibility of colors and line thicknesses and font size in Preview. Now let's talk about TeamPaper Snap from teampaper.me. It's a free menu bar app. One tap on Take Screenshot and you've got crosshairs ready to capture a portion of the screen. Hit the space bar to select an entire window, just like the built-in screen capture tools in macOS, and then click to capture. Or if you like keystrokes, you have the option to set one in Preferences. Once you capture an area of your screen, the screenshot immediately opens in a floating heads-up kind of a window. It's ready to be annotated immediately, rather than having to run over to Preview for that part of your workflow. Now, there's no requirement to remember those pesky keystrokes, and already it's faster to get to the annotations. Now, remember how I'm always annoyed at how Preview plops the annotations in the middle of the screen instead of allowing you to draw them in place? TeamPaper Snap lets you draw arrows, lines, boxes, circles, and text at a location and direction and size of your choosing. This is a much more efficient method of annotating images. You can choose different colors for your annotations, but your choices are a pale red, a pale orange/yellow, and a pale green. Want another color or a brighter, more bold color? Nope, that's what you get. Want the line thickness of the arrows and boxes to be thicker at times? Nope, that's the line thickness you get. I wrote to them and I said, how about more colors and how about more line thickness? And they said, yeah, no, we're not doing that. Oh well. TeamPaper Snap has several cool tools that make it really useful. It has a blur tool designated by a water droplet in the toolbar, and that is invaluable for obscuring that home address or phone number that's in your screenshot. In Preview and Markup, you can only plop a rectangular blob of color on top of your personal information. I really wish Preview had a blur tool. Just this week, Steve wanted to post a picture of the crazy expiration date we got on our gas credit cards. It was hilarious. It was I forget what the year was, but I know I'll be 91 when these expire. Anyway, he wanted to do that, but he needed a blur tool, and he didn't have an easy blur tool. We ended up plopping a big blob of color on it with Preview, and we could have been using TeamPaper Snap. By the way, Steve said, can you change how blurry it is? Nope, that's how blurry you get it. It's blurry enough. Probably one of the most unusual features of TeamPaper Snap is the ability to add numbered bubbles on your screenshot and add comments on the side of the shot to explain them. You tap a red circle with a 1 in it to start putting in comments. Tap on the area where you want the bubble to be, and then a comment field comes up where you can type some text. When you save the annotated image, the comments appear on the right side of the annotated image. It's pretty slick and reminds me a little bit of the way Clarify does the same thing. Once you've captured your screenshots and you've annotated it, you have several options of what to do with it. If you choose to save the image locally, the name of the resultant file will include the name of the app you were capturing, along with the date and time of the capture. I like that they include the name of the app, and of course you could rename it in the standard dialog box if you prefer. Alternatively, you can copy your screenshot directly to the clipboard. Actually, it's automatically copied to the clipboard, so you don't actually have to do anything. You can just move along and paste it somewhere. It's perfect for if you don't want to clutter up your Delete Me folder, but just want to paste it into an email or maybe a message. Finally, you can save your screenshots to a free online account hosted by TeamPaper Snap. The advantage of that last option becomes obvious when you need to share an image with someone when a simple paste into an email or message is not an option. I've run into this on discussion forums and also when posting a bug report or feature request to a software developer. As soon as you hit upload, you'll see a message that the link to the screenshot is already in your clipboard. There could not be an easier way to share a screenshot. In fact, in the live chat room, one of the things I always want to do is show people pictures of something. It might be a photo, probably of Forbes, but it might be a photo or anything else that I want to share with them. And during the show tonight, I just grabbed a couple of pictures, plopped in the link immediately. I mean, it's just so easy. You grab the screenshot, you hit paste, you've got a link. It's fantastic. In fact, John, who goes by NASA Nut in the chat room, liked it so much, he downloaded it while we've been in the chat room, and he was able to show us a picture of where the hurricane is going right now, and that it was probably going to be getting close to him. So it was fantastic that he was able to just grab that and paste it in. By the way, it does remind me a lot of Sketch that was, it was eventually bought by Evernote. I haven't used it in a long time. I'm not sure if it's a, still out there, but I think it is. This just in, Steve just told me that it is in the Mac App Store, so Sketch is still there. Haven't used it in a while. It's probably still great. Anyway, Once you've created a free account for TeamPaper Snap and you do your first upload, you'll see a change to the pull-down menu. You can now go to My Gallery, which contains all of your uploaded images that are at tppr.me. They also allow you to drag and drop any image into your gallery, so it's not restricted to images taken with TeamPaper Snap. From there, you can grab a link or delete your uploaded images one by one. Keep in mind, these are public images, so don't upload anything you don't want discovered. In a real meta moment, you'll notice that your uploaded images can also have annotations added after the fact within the web interface. Simply click and drag an area, and a comment box will be revealed. They've set this up to allow collaboration even with people who don't have TeamPaper Snap accounts. I sent a link to an image to Pat Dengler, and she was able to add a second comment on one I'd made to the image, and she was able to create a unique comment. These comments are designated, again, by the red bubbles with numbers in them. Now, I said up front that TeamPaper Snap is free. If you put annotations on a screenshot, they embed their logo in the bottom right. They have an in-app purchase of $20 that allows you to put your own logo in the bottom right instead of theirs. I like the way they offer this. They say, and I'm quoting here, "App will always be free. Think of it as a special way of supporting our future work." I think they might have meant future work, but in any case, I think that's a good way to explain their business model. If you're in business and making these screenshots, you would probably want your own logo. By the way, if you don't put any comments in and you just do annotations, there is no logo of theirs in your screenshots. We've been going crazy in the live chat room. Steve has downloaded it, installed it, says it's perfect for what he's been looking for. So who knew? I didn't try to talk him into it. He just thought it was great based on what he saw already. So if you're looking for a way to take quick screenshots, do a few annotations in an easier way than markup with Preview, and really wish Preview had a blur feature, or you want to be able to post your screenshots online, check out the free TeamPaper Snap in the Mac App Store or over at teampaper.me. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at podfeet. Now, remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. We've got podfeet.com/Patreon. But don't go to mine. Go to patreon.com/LTpod. Remember, go to Bart's. Go donate to him this week. And then go to, if you want to join in the conversation, you can go to podfeet.com/Facebook or podfeet.com/Google+. Your choice. We don't discriminate. And if you want to use the Amazon affiliate links, podfeet.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show or join us to talk in chat during the Big Apple announcement, head on over to podfeet.com/live. And to see the live show on normal times, you'd see it on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla castaways like J.F. Brissett did for the first time this week. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.